On this week's 51%, we hear from a woman whose illness led to her documentary film.
Every day I was in bed, waking up every morning, looking at the same ceiling, disappointed that I was alive.
And we hear what's changing in some states to allow pregnant teens to make their own medical decisions. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Jennifer Brea was an avid traveler, a Harvard University PhD student, and a Princeton University grad. She was engaged. And then one day she could not get out of bed with an illness that went undiagnosed for years. Finally, she started to meet other people, mostly women, who were struck with the same, a misunderstood illness, commonly known as chronic fatigue syndrome. To take control of her life and to be taken seriously, she started to film herself, others like her, and the few experts on the subject. Her resulting documentary is entitled Unrest. Jennifer Brea spoke with KALW's Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller about her battle with the illness, starting with when she knew something was really wrong.
So I got sick after a very high fever, and I thought that it was just the flu. And after the fever broke, I had that kind of rush you feel when a fever breaks and you're like, okay, it's over. I'm getting better. And then I got out of bed and tried walking to the bathroom, and I was so dizzy, I walked straight into the doorframe. And I think that was the first time I thought, okay, something's a little weird because nothing like that had ever happened to me before. And then over the course of the next year, every time I got sick with like a sore throat or a cold or something relatively minor, I would end up what I would call now crashed, but like in bed for days, sometimes weeks. And I didn't know what was happening to me, but I knew very early on that something wasn't right. I just never thought that it would last as long as it has. And it really wasn't until, you know, a year into being sick, after going kind of down, when I became essentially permanently bedridden with, you know, much deeper symptoms, sort of, you know, gastrointestinal symptoms, neurological symptoms. My whole body was in revolt. And I think that's when I knew, okay, what's happening to me now are things that I don't even have names for. I can't even describe. And I think that's when I knew that this wasn't going to be easy. And if I was going to get better, it wasn't going to happen right away. I had the sense that I was going to be living with this for a long time.
Millions of people have this, right? The fact that it's not something that could immediately be at the top of a list of a doctor's potential diagnoses is, I don't know, that was sort of startling to me.
It was startling to me too. And the fact is that's what everyone has to do. So in my community, there are patients who have become really well-versed in the science and have become experts in their own disease, because it's not something where you go in and then someone says, you know, okay, here's what you have and here are your treatment options. And that's sort of, you know, what we imagine medicine is like and how it functions. The challenge is that this disease is not taught in most medical schools. And so doctors don't have the tools to diagnose patients early. When I think, you know, there is that option of treatment or at least management to prevent further disability. And so they're not getting diagnosed and they are left, you know, frequently to figure things out on their own. And it's exhausting and it's hard. Like women I spoke to who got sick in the 80s, where they would go in and people would say things like, oh, I really think you should just divorce your husband, then you'd feel better. Or they would tell the husband, if you leave your wife, then she'll have to get better. Or if you got a haircut, you would feel better. Or if you had kids, you would feel better. Or it's because you have kids that you don't feel well. I actually had a doctor who took my husband Omar outside the room and said, you know, you can leave her if you need to.
Oh my God. and he immediately told you.
Oh, he was so livid. He wanted to. Omar is like such a gentle guy. And it was the first time in my life I've ever thought he wanted to like just punch someone. I mean, I think it has gotten better in that the sexism is more subtle. And so it's harder to define and it's harder to know that it's happening. You just sort of feel like this kind of condescension that makes absolutely no sense. And so it's hard for me to even say, oh, that's sexist, because what you're saying to me is not as outrageous as, you know, get a haircut, get a divorce, paint your nails and things will be fine. But you still can't help but wonder, if I were older or a different gender, would you really be saying this to me right now? And so it's hard to put a finger on, and I think that makes it even harder to surface.
Have you ever asked a doctor that?
I wish I had. But your doctor is your access to care. Your doctor can put something in a chart that will follow you for the rest of your life. Your doctor can make choices over whether to prescribe a drug that could make you feel much better or choose not to. And not that that power is wielded arbitrarily, but it's still power. And so I think when you have something like this and you're in a doctor's office, you want to present as the most reasonable person in the world. And you fear that if you're emotional, that's only going to affirm what they already think, which is that maybe you're just anxious, maybe you're depressed. And that's a horrible position to be put in, to have to, in some ways, not only be sick, but then also to feel like you have to always present, you know, as like respectable. But that's something that I think a lot of, you know, like minority communities talk about, right? It's like you have to sort of that concern about like, do I speak out and do I lash out and do I say what I really think and feel, or am I supposed to try to convince you that I'm worthy of your good treatment? I do think that the doctor is an expert on the body of training they've received and the experience they amass from seeing, you know, hundreds and eventually thousands of patients. And at the same time, the patient is a different kind of expert on their own individual case, right? And you need kind of both expertise to be listened to in order for that relationship to work.
Is that a male doctor thing? I mean, have you found any difference between working with female doctors versus male doctors in that, with that description?
Oh, my female doctors have been awesome. It doesn't always break down in gender terms. And the one thing I think is very important to say is that I've also known men who've been told it's all in their head. But I think that, you know, this is totally anecdotal, but almost every woman I've talked to has gotten a psychosomatic diagnosis at some point. Whereas for men, that's just less common. I mean, I had a female infectious disease doctor who was just incredibly thorough and tested me for everything that could possibly be remotely possible. It wasn't even plausible, just possible. And it was great because it helped to really rule out every other possible condition. And that was when was an important step toward getting this diagnosis. You know, and Nancy Klimas, who's in the film, is also really amazing. And I think I've had the fortune of working with a lot of really great doctors. And I do think somehow when I work with women doctors, I do have a sense that there's more of an assumption on the other side of credibility or yeah, like you're telling me the truth about what you're feeling. I've never felt in a consult room with a female doctor like I had to hide any of my symptoms.
Did you feel like each time you were unable to get out of bed, did you know you were going to get through it? I mean, I'm imagining that laying in bed and not being able to do all the things you want to do can be really depressing. And I mean, you even say in the film at some point, and I'll paraphrase, but that, you know, not killing yourself was like success. Like that was how low the bar was at one point for you.
I was never depressed though. I mean, I think that, you know, depression often follows chronic illness. And I don't know why I didn't get depressed. I'm really glad that I didn't have to deal with depression on top of everything else. I always had the motivation and the drive and the desire to keep going and to do as much as I could every day, whether I had, you know, 10 minutes or 10 hours. But it was more just a kind of rational understanding of the fact that every day I was in bed, waking up every morning, looking at the same ceiling, disappointed that I was alive. And, you know, we know what that kind of isolation does to people. Like many patients who are very severe liken it to living in solitary confinement. And it's just, I mean, it's crazy making to wake up every morning in the same place and not be able to do anything. And so I just, you know, and I was getting worse and worse and worse. Like my function was going down, 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 down. I got into a point where I could only eat three foods. I was having just like massive reactions and everything was making my joints swell and my, it was just as horrible. And so I was facing the fact that like, I probably at some point was going to lose the ability to eat. And I was also facing the fact that, you know, it was just getting harder and harder to get to the bathroom. And so I didn't know how long I would have, but I think that every day just was sort of kind of ruminating on the possibility that this was going to end in death, that it was going to end in self-euthanasia. Because I you have to understand, I'm living in a community where, you know, I'm connected to a lot of other patients online. And over the last several years, you just lose people. Like we've lost a lot of people. And I've lost people that I've known. And so it's not abstract anymore when you see other people choose to exit the pain. And when you're in that much pain every day, yeah, I thought that I might be forced to do that as the only solution to that much unbelievable pain.
Thinking about the hysteria though, because that term actually came from a problem with a woman's reproductive organs causing mental distress. Basically, right? So, and my understanding is that with many autoimmune diseases that women do get affected more than men. And women are also credited with having the sort of higher tolerance for pain and accused of being overdramatic and exaggerating their symptoms. I mean, you do have a doctor in the film that talks about, you know, she says at one point, I'm just going to be a feminist for a minute here. And then she talks about the female history of this disease. So, I'm just curious. I mean, this is a show about women. So what your impressions are of how that plays into the way that people responded to you or the way that you've seen other people responded to by virtue of the fact that it is primarily affecting women.
So I started bringing my Omar, who is then my fiance, into my appointments with me with this hope that like, well, maybe if there's like this, you know, third party male certification in the room that can say like, yes, I was there and I observed her, this happened to her, that I would be taken more seriously or at least treated better. And it definitely improved things to have him in the room. It may not have changed what anyone was thinking, but they were at least a little bit more careful about how they expressed it. And, you know, I've talked to and interviewed countless women who have been told that, you know, whether they're grappling with ME/CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, or, you know, autoimmune conditions. Or I even had a friend who had a brain tumor that was misdiagnosed as anxiety for years before they finally ran the right brain imaging to be able to see it. And, you know, I think that women's testimony of their own bodies are just not taken seriously. And I don't entirely know why. I think there are these deep inheritances in our culture that we don't even know where they come from. But I do remember when I was starting to read more about Freud and the concept of hysteria, how it was almost verbatim what my doctor told me in the office when he diagnosed me, and how he probably didn't even know where those ideas and where that kind of piece of his training came from.
What I gathered from watching the film is that one of your frustrations was you knew something was wrong and you were not necessarily getting the satisfaction of other people acknowledging it. And that by making this film, you are shining a very bright light on what was very real, what is very real, and that not everyone could see. And so I was curious about when you decided to take your phone and start filming yourself in these really hard moments.
So my whole life, I had been a writer by constitution. I've written many first thirds of a book and never finished them. But I'd always been someone who had written to know what I thought and what I felt and had always kept a diary. And after my neurologist diagnosed me with conversion disorder, I decided to test out his hypothesis, thinking like, okay, well, if I had conversion disorder, wouldn't one of the symptoms maybe be that I didn't know that I had it or that I wouldn't accept that I had it? So maybe I should just try to like live with that hypothesis for a while and see what happens. And
conversion disorder, could you just explain what that is?
So conversion disorder is this idea that, you know, you have a trauma that you might not remember, that the doctor can't prove or even describe, but it's just sort of assume a trauma that no one knows about and no one can produce. And somehow this trauma years later, after an infection, is causing you to have symptoms that have no biological cause, but feel very real to you. So I thought, okay, maybe this does happen sometimes, and maybe something happened to me and I just can't remember it. And so I walked home that day, about a mile to my house from the office, just kind of trying to notice the pain in my legs and sort of in some ways at the same time trying to think, okay, is somehow my mind creating this pain as I'm walking? Does that make sense? And so I walked home and then I collapsed on the floor. And so, you know, that is the cost of being wrong. And I've never walked that far ever again. And that's when I started to film myself, because it was just so hard to lose everything. And I didn't know what to do next. And I couldn't write anymore. Like, I would write a sentence of an email and then pass out for 4 hours. And so I had no way to cope with the experience. And I needed a place to put that pain and that fear and that grief. And so a friend of mine who is a writer said, you know, well, maybe you should just record your diary, you know, in audio, and then someday you'll go back and when you're better and you'll write about it. And my iPhone was what was close to me. So I took it out and just started filming myself. And I, you know, it wasn't until I was seeing a new doctor and told him, you know, last night I got up and I tried to walk across the room and I came back and I collapsed on the floor and I couldn't lift my head. And, you know, why does that happen? And I saw him writing in his chart and not even really making eye contact with me. And so I took out my phone and said, no, look, like, this is what happened to me last night. And he just sort of turned white and said, you know, oh my God, you need an MRI, you need a spinal tap. I don't know what is wrong, but something is clearly wrong with you. And that gave me the sense of like, okay, maybe this has to be told visually, and maybe you really can only believe what you can see with your own eyes. So I decided that I wanted to make a documentary of the personal footage, essentially when I went online and started to just meet more and more patients who had been sick for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, and started to understand just how big this issue was, how longstanding it was, how many people had, you know, fought really hard for recognition and for equality and had, you know, essentially been sidelined. And I think I felt like, oh, I came to the realization that things were not going to change without something to sort of shake them up. And I thought, okay, I don't know if I can contribute to that, but I have to at least try, because I couldn't imagine having, you know, a conversation with a younger version of myself in 20 or 30 years that was like, yeah, it was really bad back in, you know, in 2015. And so that's when I decided to make a film. And it, you know, I started telling a story in part because when I got sick, you know, I'm someone who had always looked to novels and films and stories as a way to explain my experience to myself. And suddenly I was going through the most profound change, for lack of a better word, in my life. And I had no story to hold on to in a way, because it was like the narrative wasn't there.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about getting someone to take you seriously?
I don't think it's your job to get someone to take you seriously. I think you tell the truth and you live your life, and that if someone doesn't take you seriously or won't believe you, that person's not your friend and they're not your doctor. You know, I mean, I get so many messages from people that are like, you know, my parents won't believe me. What do I say to them? What do I do? And I guess you really can't get new parents, can you? I think it's important to own what is true for you and to understand that sometimes there are people in your life that aren't going to understand, and that that's really painful. And that's really hard, but that there are also literally thousands of people out there who you don't know yet, but we're here and we will embrace you and we will do everything we can to support you and we will believe you. So I do think that there is community and connection out there, even if that's not something that's easy to find, you know, in your own home or in your own community.
That was Jennifer Brea. Her documentary is Unrest. She was speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. In more than a dozen states across the country, including Indiana and Ohio, teenage girls who get pregnant cannot make their own medical decisions. That's because laws in those states require them to get a parent's permission, and that can be hard for teens whose parents are not an active part of their lives. Esther Honig of Side Effects Public Media reports from Ohio.
Imagine you're a pregnant teen. Maybe some people advise you to get an abortion, but you want to keep this baby. When you go into labor, it turns out you don't get to decide how you'll give birth. When she worked as a delivery nurse in Cleveland, Ohio, Maureen Sweeney saw this happen to plenty of teen moms.
The one that sticks out most in my mind was probably around 2011. And it was a 15-year-old woman who was coming in labor.
Sweeney remembers the girl was scared. She didn't talk much, and she was alone.
She, you know, had no family, said she was a runaway, said it was a really bad situation.
As the labor progressed, the young woman requested an epidural, a common painkiller used during childbirth.
So I called anesthesia and talked to them, and they said without a parental consent that she would not be able to sign for her own epidural.
Sweeney decided to call the county's children's services.
Because for runaways, things like that, sometimes children's services will come down. They'll appoint somebody who's able to sign for medical consent.
But it was 3 a.m. The young woman was in active labor and an agent wouldn't be there until 9 a.m.
I had to go in, you know, sit down with her and talk about the fact that, you know, she wasn't going to be able to get an epidural and she was going to have to do this naturally.
Sweeney says the girl broke down.
Tears. I mean, she just completely folded into herself.
In Ohio and 12 other states, minors cannot consent to their own health care during pregnancy. They can receive emergency services, but nothing considered elective, like a C-section and even some prenatal care. Obstetrician Michael Kakovic struggles with this issue at his hospital in Columbus.
It's extremely frustrating. First of all, from a labor and delivery standpoint, you don't like to see anybody uncomfortable.
He often sees another side of this experience. A lot of mothers denying their young daughters an epidural as a sort of punishment for getting pregnant. Kakovic tries to talk them out of it.
To take the mom aside and, you know, say that this isn't some life lesson here. This is basically pain, and there's really no reason for somebody to go through pain.
But this may be changing. Ohio is considering a law allowing minors to consent to their own care during pregnancy. Colorado and North Dakota enacted similar laws several years ago. Abigail English is a legal advocate and has studied minor consent laws for decades. She says most states do allow pregnant teens to consent to their own care. And one by one, it seems holdout states are changing once someone advocates for it.
It certainly could be that the issue, you know, was not brought to the attention of lawmakers until recently.
Delivery room doctors and nurses are often the ones raising the issue. They say without a minor consent law, pregnant teens are denied basic rights during childbirth. Maureen Sweeney agrees.
So it's already, you know, this at-risk population that's now in a high-risk situation, and now we're putting another barrier into them being able to access that care.
There's no way to know for sure how many teens across the country are denied these elective procedures, but it's clear they're not in the position to advocate for themselves.
And teens, right, if they're told you don't have the right to ask for this, what's going to make them bring that up to an ACLU lawyer?
The Ohio bill has gained bipartisan support and is progressing through the State House. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Esther Honig.
And the story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1482.